But overall, I agree with Sean. He creates content on YouTube under Actual Justice Warrior if you want to check out his content. But what he says there is totally true.
Welcome everyone. My name is Sean, and today we got to talk about this Majority Report segment that a lot of you have been telling me about. In fact, I first learned about it when I did an appearance on Sitch and Adam, because it's crazy from top to bottom, and even though I don't normally cover nor care what Majority Report says, this segment is so bad faith, so absurd in every possible way, that we have to go over it. But before we get into that, I just want to say thank you to everybody who signed up over on actualjusticewarrior.com/join.
Give me the money. Give me the money. Okay.
And remind you that on Saturday, April 27th in Austin, Texas, I will be at Minds Fest. Link to tickets, top of the description, promo code AJW for 20% off.
Calling from 818 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
It's Dave from Jamaica. Hey, cool. How are you doing?
Dave, so good to hear from you. How are you doing?
I'm not bad. So right into the topic. I wanted to talk about crime because I know a few weeks back, you know, people are trotting out the old 90s arguments.
Oh, yeah.
How to deal with crime at home. And, you know, very frustrating from certain folks.
So right off the bat, they opened this video with a caller, and the caller is speaking with a Jamaican accent. But I have to be honest, after listening to the entirety of this person's call, I think that maybe, just maybe, this guy might be a troll. Maybe, just maybe, this guy might be an AJW fan because he talks about Jamaica, crime in Jamaica, something that we've covered recently, and explains how Jamaica's improving economically and therefore their crime is going down because everybody knows crime caused by poverty. Somebody arrests poverty. What is poverty wearing? Apparently it has fled this nation to the nation of Jamaica. Please let us get Interpol on poverty.
The thing I want to say is, though, I tend to, since I've dealt with these type of arguments for a long time, especially in Jamaica, which we still have crime issues, but less so now because there's more economic development. So I wonder why.
Now look, maybe, just maybe, this guy is completely uninformed, completely unintelligent. I mean, after all, he is watching the Majority Report as somebody who's saying that they're in Jamaica, because citing the so-called crime decline in Jamaica, how it's gone down due to economic go up, is probably the dumbest thing that you could possibly do. As we talked about on this channel, Jamaica, aside from one small nation with a sub 50,000 population, has the highest homicide rate in the world, circa 2023. So what he's saying is that the economy is improving in Jamaica, therefore crime go down, when Jamaica's number one in the world in terms of homicide rate. That would be high up. That would be up top. That's what's going on in Jamaica. Now, I don't normally trust indexes of violent crime from other countries because sometimes they have different inputs and I don't like to compare apples to oranges, but just in case you were curious, they do rank number 10, so in the top 10 in terms of the violent crime index, but homicides are pretty straightforward, they're easily measured, and they're number one in homicides. So already from the jump, they're talking about how, oh, crime caused by poverty, Jamaica economy improving, and therefore crime go down. But what we find out is, in fact, that is not the case. They appear to be uncorrelated, which makes sense because that's the same thing we find not just in the United States of America, but the world over. In fact, the overwhelming majority of evidence shows us that crime drives poverty, not the other way around, and secure property rights, basic rule of law, is what is going to help you get out of poverty.
Yeah, basically, you know, the problem is like people, this isn't a conversation about like an abstract policy or something. Like this is something that people actually experience in their everyday lives directly. Not like, oh, this policy does that and that affects this. This is a direct effect on people. Like if you're walking down the street and, you know, something happens to you, you get attacked, you get mugged, whatever, you directly experience that. So if someone's telling you that, you know, the city's been, whatever city has been safer than ever, you're dealing with people who are like, well, I just had this happen to me, so how can you say that? Because that's basically how people experience these things, or how they view it through that lens. Like, you know, when we say the city's safe, that doesn't mean there is no crime. that just means statistically it's you're less likely for something to happen. It's less likely for something to happen to you.
It was worse.
Unfortunately for those people who it does happen to, they are that small percentage in that statistic, but you know, it's hard to convince them that because, you know, they directly experienced it. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's hard to like say, like you said, like people don't listen to like stats and stuff, but this is something where like that is super important.
So this is a cat called Matt Binder or Matt Binder. Honestly, I don't know. And honestly, I don't care. And what he's trying to say is make the argument that we see a lot, that the perception is that crime up, but in reality, in actuality, crime down. Now, I will point out that I actually embarrassed this individual on an election stream on Odyssey. You probably didn't see it when I told him as a fellow New Yorker that homicide was up in 2022, 47%, the largest year-over-year increase in history. And he could not accept that reality, despite it being evidenced out by the data.
New Yorkers, really, I mean, sure, has there been some extra worry about crime in recent years or two? Sure, but that's mostly because the media has basically taken that whole narrative that New York is some bastion of crime, when the data shows that New York City is still, I believe, the safest big city in the entire country.
Yeah, but to be fair, people aren't comparing New York to other big cities. They're comparing New York now to New York a year ago, New York a couple years ago.
So I actually hadn't watched this clip before I started editing this video and when I referenced it during shooting, but I just want to point out that there's a reason why I tell people Ben Burgess is somebody that you can actually talk to, even though I vehemently disagree with him on a whole host of issues. Right there in that moment, he cut through the nonsense and actually spoke to the heart of the issue because he's actually concerned with being factual. He's not trying to just smear somebody for the sake of smearing them. And there's a reason why Ben Burgess backs up Anna Kasparian and doesn't attack her personally. And somebody like Matt Binder is a part of that leftist mafia podcast nonsense. And he does go out of his way to defame her. Again, it's right there. The character of the person on display when you detect a BS argument, Ben Burgess calls it out.
So even if
the New York, it's the trend is about the same, honestly. Anything else is perception.
That's
you can look
just
at the
not
data.
True. You have a
it 40, is. I could.
You,
I could
you have a 47% increase in homicide from 2019 to 2020, and you're like, oh, it's no big deal because it's not as bad as the 1990s. It's absurd. Like we are seeing spikes in homicide.
A 40% increase in homicide.
We had a spike in. We had a near doubling in shootings in 2020 in New York City. Like it's not what you call it. Yeah, and I'm talking about New York City was around 300 murders in 2019, and it went to around 460-something in 2020. So that's about a 47%, I think, is the right number. Like, that's a huge jump. It's one of the biggest jumps in the history of New York City. And as somebody who also lives in New York City, I can tell you people are concerned about crime. So for this clown, of all people, to say, oh, this is something that people experience, this is something that people feel, to not understand that the data reflects this, and to be trying to argue that other people don't get it, is absurd in every possible way. Again, crime is up in New York City compared to 2019 levels. We are seeing drops from the Black Lives Matter riot peaks, and those drops are significant in homicide. That is a good thing, but unfortunately for Matt Binder, unfortunately for Emma Vigeland, unfortunately for this other guy that I didn't bother to learn his name, I'm old enough to remember back in 2019. I'm old enough to understand the problems that we face then versus now. And yes, the decay of New York City is noticeable, and it's in the numbers.
Give me an example of that, though. Are you talking about you see homeless people in the streets?
Yes, there's tons of homeless people all over New York City.
I mean, because we have failed here to take care of them correctly, honestly, to actually provide services for the homeless.
Was Michael Bloomberg providing more services for the homeless?
I don't know. Perhaps people had a hard time during the pandemic and lost their jobs and never recovered. I don't know. I have to look at the data here, honestly.
Was that because of the pandemic as well? Or is that due to the fact that they don't enforce the laws and the quality of life stuff that they used to enforce against
you can't enforce people out of homelessness. You have to actually deal with the homeless problem. Just saying you're not allowed to be here isn't going to solve homelessness, and then isn't going to solve the
New
problem.
New York has the capacity for shelters for homeless people, and under Bloomberg and under Giuliani, the strategy was to enforce laws to keep them out of public places so that they would go to those shelters. So when you don't enforce that, they end up on the streets, and you see the negative signs of that. So technically, this is a side ancillary issue, but I did think it was funny that Binder was going to go with the explanation that homeless services had been cut, because according to the left, every problem is due to funding being cut, but he didn't have an answer for, you're saying Bloomberg spent more on homeless services than Bill de Blasio? In fact, a lot of these people, including Emma Viglin against me on the Culture War podcast and Sam Cedar when I was a guest on his show, tried to tell me that the preliminary New York City numbers were down, therefore it's all good in the hood, and I tried to explain to them repeatedly that those were the preliminary numbers, and we have to wait for the revised numbers, and guess what? The revised numbers recently came out from the NYPD. They were dropped in April of 2024, that is this month, of what went down in 2023. And it turns out that 0.3% decrease in crime that these guys were hanging their hats on didn't actually exist when they did the revised numbers, because these statistics take a while. And I know that they're in denial of that and they don't care about that. Crime is actually up in the seven major categories. Now, it's down in specific categories, and the increase is largely in the assault category, but assault is serious. This is something we should be concerned about. And the fact of the matter is, that pushes this seven category average over the top, meaning crime up 2023, not down, up, not down. And by the way, still elevated from 2019 levels.
Like, No one considers this until a crime happens to them. Like, no one walks through their everyday where crime doesn't happen to them and say, oh, everything's so safe, crime isn't happening to me. They ever only think about this when it does. Like, the absence of crime is not something people think of. That's the default.
So right here, what we're getting from this individual is him projecting. This is how he views criminality. I was concerned about criminality before it happened to me. I'm concerned about criminality in neighborhoods that I don't live in cities and states that I would probably never visit, because I'm concerned about the victims of crime. But for him, as long as he gets to go to his Brooklyn frozen yogurt shop and bitch about gentrification while he's there, it's not a big deal because it didn't happen to him. That's how he views the world. This is how he operates. Make no mistake about it, something doesn't have to personally happen to you for you to care about it. And it's absurd for him to suggest that. But that's how all of these dopes feel. That's how all of these commie losers feel.
But you're right, Binder, but it's also people like get titillated by it, to be honest with you, that haven't experienced it before. So like, it's driven a lot by, specifically in New York, people that live in suburbia that are obsessed with property values, that come into that read the New York Post and women that listen to true crime or something like that. And they're almost just like, well, you know, God, it's so scary, all these black and brown people in New York, and they'll read the New York Post, or if people just keep their TV on, every local news story is about some sort of crime, which completely misrepresents the trend.
So what I find amazing about this is that Emma Viglin, the person who's talking right here, is from suburbia. This is a rich Jersey girl, the daughter of two U.S. attorneys. They were also corporate attorneys. They are bundlers for Democratic Party candidates, not just ordinary donors. They collect money from other people in order to do that. And the way that Emma got into politics was that her parents got her a job with then state senator, now senator for New York, Kirsten Gillibrand. So she's talking about, oh, all these people who don't live in the city, all these people who don't live in a $4,500 a month apartment like Emma Viglin does in a very gentrified area are just scared of the blacks and browns and whatnot. If you go and look at polling, what you'll find out is that rich, spoiled brat white girls with white guilt like Emma Viglin are not the people that are concerned with crime. Yes, they probably consume true crime content, but in reality, in actuality, the people who are concerned with crime are those very same black and brown people. Go look at the Democratic primary mayoral results for the city of New York. Eric Adams won overwhelmingly among black and Hispanic areas. People like Emma Viglin voted for Maya Wiley, who was further to the left than Bill de Blasio on these particular issues. On top of that, the idea that people are titillated by being victimized by crime is one of the most disgusting and absurd things that you can possibly say, and I can only imagine how people who actually have been victimized by these criminals are reacting to this. On top of that, the reason I cover stories, the reason I pick the ones that I pick, is because they are usually due to policy failures. The idea that I'm titillated by Perkins, 11-year-old, being killed by a person who was paroled repeatedly, despite the fact that he was consistently making threats, when the mother was begging the court to actually hold this person because he had threatened her, because he had tried to enter his house, because he had a history of attacking women that left him, and that ended up costing 11-year-old Perkins his life, is absurd, asinine, and disgusting. But that's how Emma Vigeland views it, because she doesn't care about Perkins. They're about to talk about all the people who are not victimized by criminals. They're going to say, hey, when you're talking about this person who is murdered, think about the people who weren't murdered. Well, like, why don't you focus on the non-problem? But the thing is, we're concerned with murder because we're concerned with humanity. You guys are only concerned with your narrative, which is why you don't even bother to familiarize yourself with the numbers that you talk about.
You know, so I think it's also right. Like the prospect of it having to people, there's this, you know, I don't know. I it's hard for me. It's almost titillating is the only word I can think of, honestly.
Yeah, it's hard for you to understand, Emma, because you grew up going to $40,000 a year private elementary schools. You were raised in the most sheltered environment. You never actually had to live amongst a criminal population. You never had to deal with these issues. So for you, this is all an academic exercise rather than something that involves real people and real victims.
No, absolutely. That's how you have to cover it. Like, you know, the local. Local news isn't going to be like, let's say New York, 8 million people, 7.9999 million people did not have crime happen to them today. They don't do that. They go, oh, here are the 10 people that, these are the 10 news stories where 10 different people had something happen to them today. And they rinse, wash, repeat. And people see that and they go, oh, it must be scary out there or something.
This is some of the stupidest commentary I've ever seen in my entire life. The local news is not going to report a non-story. Why don't they cover the non-story? Listen, when a murder happens, what you need to think about is not whether or not we should solve that murder, whether or not the murderer in that instance was out on the streets due to a policy failure that people like Matt Binder advocated for, or whether or not there's a deep impact to the community or about the victim's family or anything like that. What you need to think about is all the other people who are not murdered. You see, when Jalen Perkins was killed in Chicago, 11-year-old, he was defending his mother from a repeat offender, a repeat abuser led out by the very policies advocated by all three of these dopes right here. What you should think about is all the other 11-year-olds across the world that weren't murdered in that very apartment. Because when you think about it like that, when you try overwhelmingly to ignore the problem, what ends up happening is you don't pay attention to the actual problem. Absurd in every possible way. The local news is going to cover stories, and what you're pitching is a non-story, a non-problem.
When, it's just, that's just ridiculous to think about it that way. Like, people's perception on this is completely, out of whack.
I mean, to see this man say that it's ridiculous to think about it that way, and other people's perception is completely out of whack, when he told you when a crime happens or a murder happens, you should think about all the people that a crime didn't happen to, it just, the comedy writes itself. What is this guy's point?
The fact that you are able to go to work, walk down the street, go to a restaurant, go pick up your kids from school, whatever, and something not happen to you 9.9 times out of 10 is the fact that things are safe.
So again, one of the most dangerous places in the world in recent history was El Salvador in about 2015-ish, and they actually topped over 100 murders per 100,000 population. Now, even at that peak, that was just 0.1% of the population that was murdered in that given year. So does that mean, because it doesn't pass his 9.9 threshold, that El Salvador was safe when it was the most dangerous place on planet Earth? Does that make sense to anybody out there in the audience? No, of course not. Obviously, there are issues. Obviously, the criminal population is a small portion of the population, and the victim population in any given year is going to be a small portion of the population. But we understand scale. We understand how this can fluctuate. We understand how we measure crime rates. We understand that violent crime can go up and go down without affecting in a given year more than 2% of the population. But the idea that we shouldn't care about that population because it's not everyone, it's not 50% of the population being killed, is asinine. And if he was to try to make that argument in any other context, you would laugh him off the stage, laugh him out of the room, and he deserves to be laughed off of this show in the same way. But unfortunately, we have other dopes that are interested in crime denial right here, present. They're going to go meet up about this again in their frozen yogurt shop, talking about how their $14 granola is a bit stale, but it is organic and it came from a farmer's market, and bitch about gentrification and how all of these people, all of these oppressors are so concerned with the criminality in those riff riffraff garbage neighborhoods that neither one of these individuals would actually go in. And if they did go in there, they wouldn't do it after about 4:30 in the afternoon because that's a little too sketchy for them.
No, no, I was just going to say real quick, prison populations, like, you have to look at this stuff systemically. And the thing is, like, even into the individual lens of, like, this person says that points to, like, society needing to control people more is just not going to satisfy even victims of crime. Ultimately, you need to look at how these things, like, what leads to rising levels of desperation, that sort of thing. But also, you can't look at something like prison without looking at the fact that that means federal money for the to imprison people. That's an industry. And also, that means, you know, that counts to the census, that the county that prison population is in. So you take people out of certain communities and put them into, like, less urban ones and count that towards, like, this is all systemic stuff. You just have to look at it that way.
Right here, we have the guy off camera who usually adds nothing but idiocy to this show, fulfilling his role as intended. So he comes in and he says, listen, you have to realize systemic prison root cause. And also I'm going to bring up prison gentrification. Now let's talk about this idea of prison gentrification. So the idea is that in certain states, certain municipalities, the prison is upstate in New York. That's where our prisons are, or in an area further away from the general population. And in terms of census, in terms of congressional representation, that can add up to a misallocation of power. Now, we're going to ignore the fact that 11 states actually banned so-called prison gerrymandering, because that's something that these people have complained about. And among them, I believe, are the state of California, which is the largest state with the largest prison population. But even with the total of incarcerated people, we're talking about at peak 2 million people. A congressional district is 700,000 people. So this guy is trying to tell you that his number one concern is the fact that there are, on the margins, potentially an increase in political power in terms of the federal government, in terms of the House of Representatives, and that's what you should be focusing on rather than murders in your community. That's what you should be focusing on, let's say if you're in Memphis, rather than a greater homicide rate than Jamaica that we talked about earlier. That's what you should be harping on. This is who these people are. Never forget about it. We're talking about victims. We're talking about real people's lives. And Emma thinks it's titillating. It's stimulating for you. This guy thinks, oh, well, you gotta focus on the people who don't commit crimes, who weren't victimized by crimes. And this dope is talking about marginal representation in the federal government as the number one issue, because all these people are concerned with is their own power. This is a massive projection fest on behalf of them, a massive exercise in crime denial, and it's embarrassing to see.
That the county that prison population is in, so you take people out of certain communities and put them into, like, less urban ones and count that towards, like, this is all systemic stuff. You just have to look at it that way.
This is all systemic stuff. You just have to look at it that way. Now, he also brought up, oh, what increases desperation? And I'm going to address that a little bit later because, again, they go with this root cause fallacy in terms of criminality. But I want them to double down on it a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, just to, you know, echo what Matt and Emma was saying, I think, you know, at local television level, you just see murder, 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 like kill, 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 which I know probably sounds a good song, but it's not. It's just the 8 o'clock news in New York City. At the, you know, more national news level, you might see statistics like Dave was hinting at about, like, falling crime, you know, overarching, like longitudinal studies about stuff. But I feel like even on national news, you don't really see that contextualized. You know, you might see that crime has fallen since the 80s or since the 90s or since, you know, some arbitrary day and time. And they might gesture to, like, changing social economic conditions in the country.
So this gentleman on the left of the screen hadn't really chimed in, and I wanted to give him a chance. I wanted to give him a fair hearing to be the voice of reason. And guess what he brought up? Crime isn't as bad as the 1990s. Guys, I don't know if you guys are aware of this. I don't know if you guys heard this. Crime is not as bad as the 1990s. Crime is not as bad as the worst period of time in American history. So there's no problem. Nothing to worry about. Ignore the post Black Lives Matter riots, homicide spike in this nation. 30% year over year, the greatest in the history of the country. Ignore the fact that we're still not down below those levels. We have not reverted back to 2019 levels because it's not as bad as it's ever been. I mean, we're not in New York City specifically experiencing 2,000 murders a year. So ignore the fact that we jumped from under or around 300 murders a year to well over 400, approaching 500. And now we're still in and around 400 per year. Just don't pay attention to that. Ignore the places, by the way, in the country where crime actually is worse than the 1990s, because those places do in fact exist, because it's not that bad. It's just 1990s, bro.
To, like, changing social economic conditions in the country. But very rarely are they going going to have someone who is just a criminologist or a sociologist come on and explain specifically what has caused the crime rate to fall, because generally speaking, America has a very conservative view on crime, and that crime is caused by intellectual and moral failings of criminals and not the material conditions that we subject large portions of this country to.
So I just want to point out right here that this guy's arguing out of both sides of his mouth. So right here, he's saying, oh, they don't talk about the social and economic changes that occurred in the United States of America, when I've argued with these people repeatedly, and what they are usually saying about this same very period of time is that the social and economic conditions actually got significantly worse. Remember, the crime wave actually started in and around post-civil rights movement during Lyndon Baines Johnson's Great Society, when welfare programs were going absolutely crazy, and it continued to the 1990s. Now, in the 1990s, when Clinton came in, somebody who they would label a neoliberal, income inequality expanded dramatically. I mean, they put out those charts, of course, they're out of context, about wages versus productivity, and all of these different things, according to them, should lead to a crime increase. But guess what? It didn't. It led to the greatest crime decline, the most consecutive years of crime declining in the history of the country. So their whole hypothesis is shut down completely by this stupid ass theory that he's putting forward right now. And when they're talking about other issues in terms of economics, you will hear them condemn this very same period for the degrading of social and economic conditions, the degrading of unions, and all that other nonsense,
which make them desperate, which give rise to criminality in various parts of the traditionally deprived communities. And so, you know, bringing people on to explain how crime actually works might be more compelling, but it doesn't fit that sort of larger narrative that crime is an individual moral intellectual failure.
Yeah, that's not how crime actually works. Again, you're completely refuted by your other talking points when it comes to economics. On top of that, I just want to point out this idea that being poor or being in a poor economic state makes you of inferior moral character may somehow jive with Emma Vigeland, who's never met a poor person her entire life growing up that didn't work for her family. But for me and for my family, for my fiance's family, this is patently absurd and ridiculous. Again, my fiance grew up in public housing, not the best conditions that you could possibly have. Her stepfather, who was very young when he got her mother pregnant, ended up having two twin babies, worked a job for years that did not give him pay increases. He struggled. He didn't feel respected or valued there, but he continued to put in the work. He endured through that because he wanted to provide for his family. If I asked this man if it would be okay for me to steal from a store because I wanted something, or if it's okay for him to do that because he struggled throughout his life, he would look at me with utter contempt and condemn me for that behavior. And this is somebody who's struggling, lived in the bad neighborhoods. We're Latinos on this side of the conversation. Over there on the woke side, we got white-guilted Emma Vigeland leading the helm of this particular topic. This is something that is completely unacceptable behavior. We know it's unacceptable behavior. And just like my family that grew up in the projects on my mother's side, they condemn this totally. But these people seem to think that if you're in these conditions, you somehow become less moral of a person. You somehow don't understand that stealing is wrong, and that's ridiculous in every possible way.
So it's difficult to get people into thinking in that sort of more progressive frame of mind. Like Matt was saying, that crime is a structural and social failure, and it can only be dealt with that way, because we just have a very individualistic society, and people are, you know, oftentimes only hearing about like crime and what causes crime and criminals on the news from like cops. You'll have like an ex-cop or like an ex-DA come on to talk about like what he thinks is causing crime. And also to your point, Emma, like a lot of people's definition of crime is still like broken windows policing. And so they see graffiti, or they see a homeless person on the street, or they see any other like long list of like urban trends like garbage, and they immediately associate that with danger.
So then this individual tries to wrap up by saying, oh, we see crime not as a structural, systemic, structural problem. We see it as an individual problem. For some reason, people are under the belief that you can control yourself, you're responsible for your own actions, when I'm of the belief that when somebody rapes somebody, in reality, that's due to economic deprivation. He's just an Aladdin that needed to feed his starving family. You see how this kind of falls apart when I bring up certain crimes but not other crimes? You get the point. But what I also want to say is that this guy goes after broken windows policing. He says, oh, people think graffiti is a crime. Graffiti is a crime. You're not supposed to vandalize other people's property. And then he says homeless people, and then he says trash. Now, I'm going to try to be charitable to him because he's an utter buffoon, doesn't know what he's talking about, and say that he's trying to comment on disorder and how that impacts people. And essentially, this argument is that your environment impacts your behavior, which, again, in multiple different contexts, a left-wing person would totally agree with. But essentially, if something looks abandoned, like nobody cares about it, then that will attract criminality. That's the premise of broken windows policing. And yeah, that's 100% true. I mean, one of the examples that I like to give is that if you go to a park and you just dump a pile of trash in one specific section of the park and nobody cleans it up and you come back 2 weeks later, that trash pile will be bigger because what you've actually done is normalize the idea that that's where the trash goes there. There's a bunch of different psychological experiments about this particular phenomenon, and for them to deny it because broken windows, they were told, is scary, and that's not good because we don't like broken windows because, God forbid, we do anything that works, is absurd. It's an illogical position for them to hold. Once you realize that the premise of broken windows is environment can impact behavior, arguing against it makes you look as dumb as everybody on this Majority Report panel, including the guy behind the camera.
You know, I think that specifically the issue of homelessness, I think that is a huge driver of this this fear mongering over crime that we're seeing right now. Mm-hmm. Because without a doubt, you know, crime is down. But also, homelessness has gone up over the past few years. Mm. There is a distinct rise in homelessness. Now, being homeless is not a crime. And people who are homeless are no more likely to commit crime than anyone else. In fact, they're more likely to be the victim of violent crimes than be the ones to commit violent crimes.
So then Bindner puts forward this idea, and we've heard different variants of this statistic, that homeless people are more likely to be victimized by criminals than actually be the perpetrators in those particular situations. And while this could be true, I would point out that that's because they're being victimized by the criminal homeless population that people like him do not want to address. In fact, one of the things that we've learned is that homeless people are significantly more dangerous than the general population. In fact, as far back as the 1990s, we knew that homeless people with mental illnesses are 35 to 40 times more likely to be a violent perpetrator than a person who actually lives in a place with a mental illness. Now, people like Matt Bindner like to do the same trick that he's been doing throughout the whole course of this conversation and broaden the denominator with mentally ill people that are not homeless, even though obviously the homeless ones are more likely to have severe mental conditions. And this is why I'm in favor of removing them from the streets and forcing them into psychiatric care when they can't take care of themselves, when their conditions are obvious. But he doesn't talk about that. He doesn't bring it up. He just says, oh, we need to give them free apartments because that's going to solve all their problems.
And people who are homeless are no more likely to commit crime than anyone else.
Now, I do want to point out, even though I just gave you the comparison of mentally ill homeless versus non-mentally ill homeless, if you look right below the highlighted portion on the screen, what you will see is that the San Diego Attorney General's office actually found that homeless people are 514 times more likely to commit a crime than a member of the general population. So when he says no more evidence that they're likely to commit a crime versus the average citizen, it's 514 times more likely. And by the way, 98% of the cases, repeat offender. Also, this reference page that I'm citing will be linked in the description, and you can go and click through all the different various studies in various parts of the country that show the same thing with the homeless population. Now, I do want to add that I think part of the cause of this is the fact that the homeless population is so disproportionately mentally ill. In fact, that is part of the reason that's driving them onto the street in the first place. And again, you can be sympathetic to that. You could acknowledge that that's a reality and, like me, advocate for them to be put into psychiatric care against their will, by the way, because most of them would refuse it, while also acknowledging that they're dangerous. Again, you can have a mental illness, but a mature person understands that while that's horrible for you and you should get help in that, you can also be a danger. These people are incapable of holding both of those thoughts in their head at the same time. Sympathetic for the ill, understand the potential danger. Try it. Just try holding those thoughts in your head at the same time.
In the same way that the organized retail theft headlines were pushed by real estate, or by by what do you call it? Retail organizations, and the National Retail Federation, I believe it's called. And then you find out that, oh, those numbers were completely fugazi and they made them up to cover up the fact that they reopened like a Target store in an area that didn't have enough business. And so then they blamed it on shoplifting.
Now, there's also a point here where they bring up shoplifting, retail theft, and Emma's like, oh, it's totally overblown. And she cites that organized retail theft number that we never used on this channel because I knew for a fact it was a misprint, because in that very same report, they had a completely different number. So it was just something that was taken out of context. But we still have that level of retail theft going on. And in fact, in the city of New York, we've seen a 77% increase post the Black Lives Matter riots. And I would like to draw your attention to the beginning of this chart, which is post 2008, where we had the Great Recession, a lot of people in economic trouble, people losing their homes. And we saw no such increase in retail theft in the city of New York. This is because the laws were still solid at this period of time, unlike post the Black Lives Matter riots, where we had all of these different rollbacks, where we had bail reform that releases repeat offenders same day automatically. Again, 327 people responsible for a third of the shoplifting arrests in the city of New York, and they keep getting re-released. So yes, this is down to policy. Yes, this is down to what you guys are advocating for. And no, crime is not necessarily driven by poverty, and the Great Recession is a great example of that. You can find all these different articles about the crime wave that never occurred post-Great Recession, completely disputed, debunked, destroyed this theory. And in fact, you can track crime charts over time compared to different recession periods, and what you'll find out is there's no correlation between the two. In fact, even at the Great Depression, after Prohibition was repealed, crime declined. It didn't go up. And this is not counting the World War II years. So everything that they're putting forward about how, oh, you have to arrest poverty, we have to find out what poverty is wearing, put out an APB on poverty, has been debunked time and time again. It's old, tired nonsense, not backed up by anything. But in reality, they don't care about crime. They don't care about the criminals. What they want to focus is pushing their policy agenda no matter what. That's why they lie. That's why they deny. Now look, there is a whole other part to this video where they talk about squatters' rights, and of course, they come down on the side of the squatter without actually defending any of the actual cases that we're talking about in terms of squatting. Now, if you guys want me to do a response to that latter half of the video, let me know down in the comments below. Show me with your like buttons, and maybe, just maybe, you'll get the part two of this where I address the squatting issue. Maybe I'll do that. I don't know. You'll have to see. But as usual, if you like this video, show them by leaving a like, subscribe for more content, follow me on my social media, support me via support links in the description of this video. This has been me talking about this nonsense being put out by the Majority Report. Till next time.